Hello and welcome. My name is Peter Goadsby, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us today for our educational activity entitled Optimizing Care for Diverse Patient Populations with Migraine, an exploration of migraine management with a focus on CGRP receptor antagonists. Today's program is supported by an educational grant from Pfizer. This CME activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, a jointly accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians worldwide. You can also follow us on Twitter, now known as X, where you can find announcements for the future, continuing education programs, healthcare news, and more. As I mentioned, my name is Peter Goadsby. I'll be the moderator for today's program. I'm Professor of Neurology and Director of the King's Clinical Research Facility, King's College London, and Professor Emeritus of Neurology at the University of California, Los Angeles, California. I'm very pleased to be joined today by an excellent panel who I'll now ask to introduce themselves.
Hello, good evening. My name is Cynthia Armand. I'm an associate professor of neurology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, as well as the clinical director of the Montefiore Headache Center and the fellowship director of our training program. It's great to be here tonight with all of you.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Hi, I'm Dr. Susan Hutchinson, and my background is actually family medicine, but I'm certified in headache, and I'm director and founder of Orange County Migraine and Headache Center here in Irvine, California. And it's a pleasure to be with all of you.
Well, excellent. Thank you for introducing yourselves, and thank you, Susan. Our first learning objective today is to develop strategies to address unmet needs for diverse and underserved patient populations with migraine. We have some interesting data regarding the burden of migraine, which we hope to set the scene for the program today. I'm going to ask Cynthia to take us through that data and tell us what she thinks about it. Cynthia?
Thank you so much, Peter. So it's really important to understand this burden, because when you see patients who come in with migraine, you can really understand what you see in the office and translate that to what's going on outside of the office, because we see a snapshot. You can see here 1 in 6 individuals in the U.S. are diagnosed with migraine, and actually 1 in 5 women in the U.S. are diagnosed with migraine. Think about that in the demographics that you see in your office. Migraine is the second most common cause of disability worldwide. And when you're thinking about treatments and thinking about how it impacts individuals' daily lives, it's important to remember that. We do know that migraine affects individuals in their most productive years of life. And so it's important to see that fact there. 40% of individuals in these demographics do report at least one unmet treatment need. So think about that when you see your patients and ask at the end of the visit any extra questions, anything else, that it's important to seek that out. And then we do see here that in the data, about 26% of adult patients with episodic migraine overcome healthcare barriers to obtain appropriate acute treatment. 26, I think that's far too many, especially when it comes to something like episodic migraine, when there are a lot of treatments that are available.
So let's get the audience straight into this. This is an audience response question. If you could click on the option that you think is best. Which of the following is true regarding disparities seen in patients with migraine? Let's see what you think about that. We'll return to the answers in a little while. We've got some data also concerning disparities that exist in diagnosis. So, Cynthia, you want to take us through these?
All right. So I want to preface this by saying that we are looking at these disparities here in terms of ethnicity. When you look at the literature in terms of disparities in migraine and headache disorders, ethnicity is one of the disparities that we have the most data on. And data is being collected on other parameters, such as geography, sexual orientation. But ethnicity here we're focusing on. And you can see here, kind of think of this as a sandwich. You see the U.S. prevalence of migraine for Black, White, and Hispanic individuals, and you see for American Indian, Native American, Native Alaskan natives, they have the highest prevalence at 19.2%. When you look at Black, White, and Hispanic, it's more or less equivalent. Now, you would think that in that demographic, the equivalence means they're on the same level playing field. We're getting this, we're getting everyone. However, if you see in the middle of the sandwich here, in terms of ethnicity, there are disparities that pop up in different groups that you can see. So for example, you see here the populations that are less likely to receive migraine diagnosis in the data. So there are Black individuals and Hispanic individuals. And you'll see the percentages as compared to white individuals. Black individuals are more likely to report higher burden of disease, burden of allodynia, which is sensations that are felt by stimuli that are not painful. They report a higher level of pain intensity, and they have more monthly headache days and a lower quality of life. This is what we're gathering in their visits. Black patients are less likely to be prescribed acute migraine therapy as compared to their white counterparts. And they are more likely to have mistrust in the medical community. And we see that when we look at the different social determinants of health of Black individuals. For the Hispanic patients, we see that they are less likely to seek care by their PCP when it comes to headache diagnoses. And they're less likely to receive prophylactic treatments when they go to U.S. ambulatory care settings. Now, certainly with that equal prevalence, you see how there are differences in the ethnicities in terms of migraine and headache care in general.
I think I think it's remarkable. When we were first teaching about this maybe 15, 20 years ago, everything seems like yesterday in middle age. I don't think we recognised that there was an equivalence in terms of burden numbers in the Black community and the white community. This is a real wake up call because it's not something we've been saying in teaching in the past. We've missed something here.
Right. That's what's so disturbing to me. Yes. Because we think that we're not recognizing that. Yes. And the problem is there's a blind spot and we have to find that blind spot.
Yeah. And that brings us on to nicely into the next slide. Why do these disparities exist?
Exactly. When we look at the disparities, we think about what exactly is causing those disparities. Where do those blind spots come from? And we see that they come from social determinants of health. And these are the conditions in which we live, we eat, we play. Think about your patient's total environment, what they experience on a day-to-day level, that is what's influencing their access and to education, their access to healthcare and quality healthcare. What's going on with their jobs? What's going on with the economy? How are they being affected by all of that? Finding all of those social determinants of health are very, very important in order to diagnose headache disorders, especially migraine, and treat your patients. Because then when you know more about them and the environments that they live in, you can really tailor their treatments to them and their circumstances, right? You don't want to talk about a drug that's $700 that your patient cannot afford when there are other treatments that cost less and there are more easily attainable that you can speak to your patients about that as well. So that's really important. And I know the next question is, how do we find these determinants of health, social determinants of health? You take a history. You take an expanded social history. And I will say that it's not only in the first visit that you get this information. That information accumulates from visit to visit to visit. When you start to recognize these issues, your patients will come in and they'll divulge more. And then you'll be able to gather all of these social determinants of health to help you treat them better.
Susan, yeah, I mean, this is something you've been doing your entire career, getting across people over a period of time and making sure that treatment fits their circumstances. It's an area that you'd have a lot of experience with, I think, Susan.
No, I totally agree. And I agree with Cynthia so much that I think patients are sometimes embarrassed to tell you about their finances, or maybe they've stopped paying for health insurance or they're on a government plan. And I think the more we can create just this, you know, caring atmosphere where they can freely tell us, because I know for me, when I have patients, as Cynthia mentioned, I really think about affordability and accessibility. And I'm not going to put a patient who has very little finances on an expensive medication and have them go to the pharmacy and be embarrassed. So I think knowing what is accessible and affordable to our patients is one way to be very aware of treating patients appropriately in this context.
Totally. So Cynthia, I think that leads us to the actionable strategies.
Yes,
which we're going
absolutely.
To talk about. Are you going to tell us about?
So when we think about what can we do on a day-to-day basis to help our patients, I think of the first two boxes as what pertains to our patients, and how the first box is what can we do to prepare for the visit. The middle box is when they're in the visit, what can we do? And then the bottom box is basically what can you, the providers, do little steps day-to-day in order to help your patients better. And so speaking to the first top boxes, you really want to think about your patient's access. What are they facing? What barriers they're facing in order to actually get to your clinic? You want to think about the social risk factors that might prevent them from making the visit, coming late, what's going on with when they show up late. Is it a hard 5 minutes? They're late 5 minutes. Oops, sorry, can't see you. That's not appropriate for a patient who takes two buses and a train, as I'm in New York City, which very often happens, and they come in for their Botox appointment. Not appropriate. So you want to make sure you have some sort of contingencies in place for that. Also, language is something else that we want to make sure patients can have really accessible for them. Translators for languages, as well as sign language interpreters, things of that sort. When we think of the middle box, we want to think of what creative tools can you have in order to communicate with the patients. Sometimes they're not the best historians, maybe because they've been waiting for this appointment for a very long time and they just are overwhelmed and don't know where to start. So you want to be able to have some sort of regimented way that's very easy and quick and manageable for your patients. And the last thing is, kind of a little bit something for you guys. The American Headache Society has a great program, Next Generation Migraine Therapies. If you actually Google that together, it's one of the first things that pop up. And there's a program there that can show you some therapies, teach you about therapies that are coming out, that are new, that you can learn about for your patients to start to implement. Maybe you're the first pass and they're waiting for a neurologist or they're waiting for a headache specialist. You can really do a lot for them before that next appointment. And you want to also educate your patients, make sure you write everything down for them, and make sure there's an accessible way for them to get into contact with your office, because that can be a barrier itself.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, in a busy clinic, if someone's late, you kind of get a slot. I think we're all human, get a bit maybe irritated by it.
Yes.
I'm reminded, I'm old enough now to have to go to doctors occasionally myself. It's a big deal. I've got to take time out here, do that. You know, it really is a big deal. And as difficult as it is for us when someone's late, they're there because they've got a medical problem. They're not there for entertainment. So it's important to remember to be kind. I think it's a very useful word. Let's see let's revisit the audience questions. We've had a bit of information. Let's see what the audience felt about the first question. We're getting our responses, and then we'll see see what the answer is. Okay. Well, I think we've done a reasonable job of thinking about these issues, and we may get further questions come up during the program, and we're happy to revisit any of these things later on. But you've really kicked us off in a absolutely splendid fashion, Cynthia. So I'm going to move us to objective two while I thank you. And we're going to now turn to utilizing validated screening tools and diagnostic aids such as the International Classification of Headache Disorders in its third edition to diagnose acute migraine. And we couldn't have anyone better than someone who diagnoses it every day. Susan.
Thank you, Peter. As I mentioned at the beginning, my heart really goes out to all of you that are in busy primary care settings as I used to be, because let's face it, people come in with 5 or 10 things on their list, and you're supposed to cover everything. So hopefully some of the comments I'm going to make and the tools I'll show you can help you when you're thinking about how to approach and evaluate that patient who's complaining of headache, among other complaints they're coming in for, and you've got a really busy schedule. I think most of you probably are scheduled every 15 minutes, which is pretty typical for a primary care setting. We're going to start off with a case and think about Sharon being in your practice on a busy day. 33-year-old black female, recurring headaches, last about 4 to 6 hours. They're about 4 to 6 times a month. They are moderate to severe in intensity. They tend to be unilateral, one-sided, pulsating, aggravated by physical activity. There is the presence of nausea and vomiting, light and sound sensitivity, certainly disruption in family life. And very significantly, I think a very key part of the history is that family history, both her mother and aunt. She's got hypothyroidism, so she's on thyroid supplement, and then she takes Tylenol, acetaminophen, for her headaches. And again, she's coming to you because she's not doing well. So what are some barriers to diagnosis? Well, in one study of 200 patients, and this is very sad, is that only about 16.5% in this study of 200 had the diagnosis made less than a year after the onset. But look at this, for about 30%, you know, it took 1 to 5 years, but then 53.5% from the onset, in order for it to be properly recognized and diagnosed, it was over 5 years. Now, it's not all us as providers missing the diagnosis. Quite frankly, some patients are simply not coming in with their migraines because they think, well, it's just a headache. And certainly that's where we can come in to help. And unfortunately, as Peter mentioned with the pediatric population, younger age is associated with a longer time to diagnosis. Lower education level, as Cynthia mentioned, longer time to diagnosis. And patient history, sometimes they're not really great historians. They kind of go all over the place sometimes with their symptoms. But to be honest, sometimes we're not the greatest at history taking. One of the things I've learned is it's really hard for me because I like to talk, but just to sometimes ask an open-ended question and just ask the patient, please tell me about your headaches, focusing on your worst headaches. And often if you just listen for a few moments, they will tell you all the key symptoms that you need, that you would have asked about. And so I think sometimes in a very short time, and studies have shown that open-ended questions do not take more time than closed-ended. In a busy primary care setting, you're mainly thinking, is this migraine, tension, cluster? And please, sinus headache is not a primary headache. It's rare, and when it does exist, it's a secondary headache due to acute sinusitis. So mainly think migraine, tension, cluster. And the reality is, most of the time when a patient presents to you with the complaint of a headache, usually in an outpatient setting, it's going to be migraine. So let's look at the criteria, and I'm not going to read these in detail, but I think it's good to be aware that there is this international classification of headache disorders, and this is very useful for research and you know, manuscript writing, but it's still good for you to be aware, particularly if you have a patient that you're not quite sure, it might be useful, and there's free access to these criteria, you know, on the internet. But migraine without aura is what you're going to be seeing more commonly, and if you think back on the case, she pretty much, our case, had most of these symptoms. The main thing in looking at tension versus migraine is tension, by definition, is only mild to moderate in disability. So when you're getting into migraine, think about degree of headache, degree of disability, looking for those associated symptoms of nausea, vomiting, sensitivity to light. And then less common, but you will still see it, is migraine with aura. And typically the most common we'll see is visual. And usually the person sees, you know, funny visual wavy lines in their visual field. Sometimes it's negative visual aura where they lose vision. But you can have things like slurred speech. You can have numbness and tingling on one side of the body. And it can be really scary. So sometimes when patients come in, they're not even telling you about the headache that follows. So it's good to be aware. And just one thing I'm going to point out, because I think I overdiagnosed aura when I did just family medicine before I became a headache specialist. If a patient says they see a shiny spot for 1 second, that's not aura. I think just a key thing is that an aura needs to last and happen gradually over at least 5 minutes. So again, you will see migraine with aura, and some patients have both. They have migraine with and without aura. But rather than focusing in great detail on those, I think it's much more useful to now spend a few moments looking at what can be really practical and useful in a busy outpatient setting. I really like this ID migraine. And you simply ask three questions. So you ask the patient, let's focus on the last 3 months. Did you have the following with your headaches? Did you feel nauseated or sick to your stomach? Did the light bother you more than when you don't have a headache? And really important, was there any limitation in your ability to work, study, do what you needed to do? And if the patient answers 2 or 3 out of 3, there's a very high sensitivity and specificity for migraine. And Peter and Cynthia, just a comment, this has probably been the most useful thing I have found, particularly when I was trying to do headache, but I was still in a busy primary care setting.
Now, I think you can apply it in research as well. I mean, we've used it broadly to screen populations. And it's one of the things that about that ID migraine is it seems so simple, you'd think that was nonsense. But Richard Lipson, well, you would. It just seems too simple. Richard Lipson did a very, very good job validating those numbers. And for a couple of questions to be able to get 75% or better with 92% specific, it's extraordinary, and it's got a very solid scientific background methodologically speaking. So that's just not a, like, ask a few questions because we think it's a good idea. There's a very good background here.
Yes, and I like the fact that it's focusing on the last 3 months, because what can really be cumbersome is when patients start telling you about their headaches from 20 or 30 years ago. So here you can take a moment and say, let's focus on the last 3 months. Now, here's another questionnaire, and this is meant to be answered by the patient. So this is meant to be, you know, if a patient's wondering, do I have migraines? So these are questions that they can answer and then come to you thinking that maybe they have migraines. So the questions are simply, do you have frequent or intense headaches? Do your headaches usually last more than 4 hours? Do you suffer from nausea when you have a headache? Does light or noise bother you? And does your headaches limit any of your activities? You can see there's a theme. You start seeing these same symptoms over and over again, no matter what questionnaire, and even when you're looking at the ICHD criteria. Very important is having patients keep a headache diary. Now, this is a little bit old-fashioned because it shows the old paper. Certainly, there are many, many electronic. There are many apps. Most of them are free. And so most of my patients now keep track of their headaches electronically. Some still do it the old-fashioned way. But please, please, as their provider, if you're going to ask a patient to do a diary, please ask to look at it on a follow-up visit, because that validates how important it is. And I find that sometimes just a glance, particularly with the fancier electronic apps and the printouts, I can often tell at a glance, wow, this person's doing really well, or hold, oh, they're not doing well, we really need to reevaluate our treatment. And so it can help me as a clinician to look at that diary at the beginning of the follow-up visit. So, Peter, I'm going to turn it back to you now.
Thanks. Well, you've covered quite a lot there in a short period of time with the usual alacrity. Cynthia, tips and tricks from your perspective on the all-important history taking?
Right. So I run a fellowship program and we have headache fellows. And what I recognize the most about this tips and trick is when they're starting to learn about taking a headache history, there's a lot of frustration that comes in when the patient is disorganized. And so when the frustration comes in, they become short, they don't ask open-ended questions, and then that's it, they're done. I like a basic headache questionnaire that somehow the patient can have before they come to the visit, because they take the time to fill out the questionnaire. When you have the questionnaire in front of you, you can then rest assured and ask open-ended questions. Things are already filled out, and you can have this template ready for you to look at what the answers are, so that if someone is disorganized, your questionnaire is organized. You fill in and look at the data that they're giving you, matching the questionnaire whenever, wherever it comes in, and then you see where the dots are filled out, and then you take it from there. That really helps you have an organized template for your note-taking and also for history-taking, so that you don't miss things. So it's all there written out for you, and you can take the questionnaire and create a template for it. So I like to have something prepared in advance that I can reference while I'm taking the history, so I can let the patient just say what they need to say and actually focus on listening.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think actually, Susan, you actually said one of the pearls I wanted to say, and I'll just sort of draw people's attention to it. If you want to, if you've got someone come in and want to talk about headache, a really good way forward to start with is tell me about the worst one. Don't tell me that you've got five different types. Okay, some that's okay. Tell me about the worst one. Why are you here? Which is the one you would like me to do something about? Because that will vary. I see that as the grown up one. You know, that's the boiling water. Because mostly you're looking at water. It's either boiling, it's either hot, it's bubbling, or it's boiling. And you get the boiling one, but they're all still water. What we talk about is it's migraine. But if you get the person to talk about their worst one, then the symptoms are going to be much clearer in the worst one. And then the milder ones, it's more or less all going to follow. And you made that point, and I do want to highlight it because I think it's exactly what I tell my fellows to do. Start with the worst one. And by the time you've sorted the worst one out, if you can do that, the person will be grateful to you, to any rate for doing that. It's a very good point, very strong point. Very strong. We have had a few more questions come in, so let's see what there's a few discussing hormone cycle impact on migraine. We could say a few things about that because that's part of the history, getting a little bit the relationship, do you think, with menses?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, Peter and Cynthia, I think you can't do justice for any female presenting with migraine unless you know what her hormonal status is. You don't have to be an expert. You may not be the gynecologist, but you need to know, are they on contraceptive? And is there any association of their migraine getting worse around the time of menses? Because many of our women with migraine do have menstrual migraine. And that's important because that's going to tie in with your treatment. And I think we're going to talk more about that because I think one of our cases at the end, I think there's migraine exacerbation around time of menses.
While we're on diaries, someone's asking, should a headache diary be used for a while? For how long would you like the headache diary to be ideally or aspirationally as someone's coming in? How long do you ask for?
Peter and Cynthia, I think that depends on the patient. I have patients, that's part of who they are. They keep their diary, all the time. But most of them, I tell them, you don't have to put, on the day you don't have a headache, you don't have to put anything in. So my goal with their clinician is we have them have as few of headaches as possible so the diary is not, it's not too cumbersome.
I think as a baseline, with many of the diagnoses in the International Headache Classification, you need 3 months to establish some sort of chronic ailment. So as a baseline, when they're first coming in, you want a baseline of 3 months. But after they get the hang of things, I agree. It really depends on the patients. I have many that are type A personalities that really depend and rely on the headache diary. Some don't need it. But if you have someone that has trouble, especially trouble with recall, I think the diary can be helpful, particularly for those patients, so you can really see past the snapshot of the visit.
Yeah, I like the I like 3 months for the reason that you document in the note in my clinical note that we reviewed a 3 month diary. And if you're having a peer to peer discussion and someone's trying to give you a bit of lip about the diagnosis, if you've got 3 months written on, you can actually you'd actually clarify that without any trouble. So let's move. Let's recap on Sharon, 33-year-old black female with four to 6 hour headaches 4 to 6 times per month. We talked about the background and we talked about we've covered a little bit the differential diagnosis and I think the screening tools, maybe education and counselling. Well, let's just make sure we stay on time. Let's make a few comments about that. How do we educate Sharon? How do we counsel us? Susan?
Well, certainly I think this is an example of episodic migraine. I mean, she's giving us all these symptoms that meet the criteria. But I think when patients leave, that's not enough. And so I try to tell them about educational resources because I want them to learn and kind of take ownership and have this be a collaborative effort, not just me telling Sharon what to take. So I might mention our own, American Headache Society with the patient information, also National Headache Foundation. So I try to give resources that are not biased, but because I really want that patient to try to learn more And also to be sensitive to the fact that some patients don't like the diagnosis of migraine. There's been stigma associated with that.
Yes.
So sometimes they prefer to call it their sinus headaches or their tension headaches. So I think we need to be sensitive to that. But once they accept the diagnosis, to try to give them good educational tools that they can access before the next visit with us.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Cynthia, same thing?
I think to harp on the point of diagnosis, and we do have a lot of patients who come in and they want the MRI. And when the MRI comes back negative, well, what is it then? Like, I don't understand. And it's really, within that education, it's important to point out, this is a neurologic disease. This is something that's managed like high blood pressure, diabetes. And so once that point starts to come out, they start to treat it as such, and it almost becomes an art form and some sort of duty that they, okay, when this happens, this is what I do. And it's important for them to put the power back in their hands, because what happens with migraine is there's a loss of control. You don't know when the attacks are going to happen. Oh, what are we going to do? But putting the patient back into control is giving them education about what it is, and also the toolbox that they give them. All right, if this happens, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do plan A. If plan A is not working, I go to plan B, and then you go to plan C. That type of education, I think, helps the patient from being demoralized to getting the control back, and they're able to manage better.
Exactly. And talking about background and what have I got, and it's a disease, it brings us to very neatly, thank you for that segue, Cynthia, to our third learning objective, which is to incorporate the latest efficacy data for the role of CGRP receptor antagonists into our decision-making process, both for acute treatment and for the preventive treatment of episodic migraine. So just a little slightly complex but not dreadful slide, which talks about calcitonin gene-related peptides, CGRP. It's part of a family of peptides, the so-called calcitonin gene-related peptide family. We target the receptor, the calcitonin gene-related peptide receptor. It's a very specific receptor, which has two components to it, a large component called the G-protein coupled component, which is, you might think about the same type of family of receptor as, say, a beta blocker that propranolol would block, and a special little component called a RAMP, or receptor activity modifying protein, that sits on the cell surface and really creates its specificity for CGRP. GPANTS block that receptor. They're a competitive antagonist. And of course, some of our other treatments, for example, monoclonal antibodies, will bind to either the receptor or bind to the CGRP itself. There's a lot of speculation about what is the important component of the mechanism in respect of these CGRP targeted treatments. And I think it's fair to say of triptans, we know a lot about the pharmacology. We know what triptans are. They're 5-HT1B1D serotonin receptor agonists. We know that GPANTS are CGRP receptor antagonists. But the detail of exactly how they do their job, I think that's something we're all still discussing for both classes. And there are a range of things, and some of them are mentioned there. I'm a bit of a central trigeminal, central sensitization brain sort of guy, I have many respectable colleagues who are more into nociceptive activation and neurogenic inflammation, of course, cortical spreading depression in aura. So it's fair to say to a patient that we know how these drugs work in the sense of their pharmacology, what part of the body they're interacting with, and we have a reasonable idea of some of the mechanisms behind how that improves headache. And I think one of the important things about evolving pathophysiology is it gives a tangibility, a credibility, a concreteness to migraine, which has been otherwise somewhat woolly in the way people have described it. I think that's actually been useful for our patients. So let's get our audience back into this, see if we can hit the high points on responses. Which is the only CGRP inhibitor, so that is FDA approved for both acute treatment of migraine and preventive treatment of episodic migraine. Thanks for all the responses. It does give us a sense that we're not talking to ourselves, so that's great. Thank the audience for that. Let's go through some of the data for these newer drugs. This is data from Ubrojapan, the so-called Achieve 1 studies, a phase 3 study. Ubrojapan 50 and 100 milligrams versus placebo, 400 plus patients in each group. The key things from the point of view of FDA are the pain freedom and most bothersome symptom response. And you see there both significant 11.8% versus 21.2% and 19.2%. And really something that's not the canonical, not the registration endpoint, but terribly important to patients. Proportion of people who have normal function 2 hours after the dose. You see the odds ratios here, nearly 2 for the 100 milligram dose. And that's really important. Whatever we do, we've got to be putting people back to normal function. And then you look on the right side, there's virtually no price that people are paying. Really modest rates of nausea, 1.6% in placebo, the top rate of 3.3%. That's 3 out of 100. Those numbers are really small. These are very well tolerated medicines. And in the next slide, I've got Achieve 2. And if it looks pretty similar, it is. The doses were 25 and 50 milligrams. Can you see both of them were superior to placebo? Again, that return to normal function for 50 and 25 milligrams being quite substantial compared to placebo, and incredibly well tolerated medicines. So a really important achievement, I think, the GPANs have right across the class is the ability to give the patient something, but not take anything away from them in terms of providing them with side effects. Now, the latest one of the GPANs, Zavegepant, which is an intranasal formulation, 10 milligram dose again there versus placebo. So, and you can see these are the two endpoints the FDA uses, 2 hour pain free at 24% versus 15% for placebo, and 40% most bothersome symptom free versus 31%. The way that's done is the patient's asked to nominate nausea, photophobia or phonophobia at the start of the attack. And to be a successful migraine treatment, you have to have had 2 hour pain free plus that most bothersome symptom to be gone. So it's not a bad bar. And again, it's a very well tolerated medicine with some nasal symptomatology adverse events, it has to be said. And that's not surprising for a nasal formulation. And then the Rimagepan study, this is the so-called 303 study. This is the orally dissolving formulation. Again, primary endpoint of pain-free at 2 hours. See there, 21.2% versus 10%, 10.9% for placebo, and most bothersome symptom of 35% versus 26.8%. On both endpoints, you have Rimagepan beating placebo. And again, incredibly well tolerated. See the results for nausea, dizziness, they're all rather modest. Now, if the numbers all look the same from what I've just said, you wouldn't be surprised, because there's a fidelity in these pathways. There's some distinctions to be drawn between the medicines, but there's a fidelity in the mechanism which tells you, great, they respond. And it also means that you can add up in some way the adverse events across the program and know that there are literally thousands of people who've been in these clinical trial programs and been monitored over time that have not had adverse event problems. And in many ways, that's one of the most reassuring things of having multiple of these medicines being tested now, is that the mechanism has been well road tested and it turns out to be quite safe. Now, Rimagepant's also approved for the preventive treatment of episodic migraine, and this is the results from the clinical trial. I'll draw your attention, the most useful one is the second one. I find for prevention, it's really quite useful to tell people what the response rate will be like. So the response rate is 49%, so let's say 50%, a halving of the number of attacks. I don't find telling people they've got minus 4.3 was the number. That doesn't mean much to my patients, but telling it's half, that's something they can translate straight away, and I find that useful with very much very useful with preventive medicines. And again, the adverse events, as you'd expect, very modest, even when you're giving the drug every other day, as was done in this study, because the pathway and the mechanism has a fidelity to it. The next of these is atogepant. This is the so-called advanced studies published in the New England Journal. This medicine is approved for the preventive treatment of migraines, the episodic study, and it's now approved for the treatment of chronic migraine. Look at the data there. Really quite handsome response, -2.5 days for placebo, -4.2 in the 60 milligram dose and -3.9 in the 30 milligram dose. And then look at the tolerability. Apart from constipation, which is around 10% more or less, again, this is very, very well tolerated medicine. So let's go back and review what we did, which is the only CGRP inhibitor that is FDA approved for both the acute treatment of migraine and the preventive treatment of episodic migraine. Oh, splendid. I can see that we've had a... Mm-hmm. That's great. There's been a... Oops. Sorry. I went too fast. There's been a turnaround of things. That's so great. People have listened to what we've had to say and can see that it's true that rimegepant B is the answer, and we've just nearly doubled the number of people in the post-test. So... thank you for listening. It's very, very rewarding for us. We're going to come back and talk about GPANs because we're going to move on now. What I'd like to do is move on to some cases. Let's talk first about Danny, 30-year-old female lawyer, has to push through court cases with migraine, wants something that's fast so she can properly represent her clients and perform at her best. Susan.
You know, I would want to know if she's taken a triptan, because for some patients, triptans are great. Yeah. Taking, you know, the cost, you can't beat the cost. I have a feeling because she's in court, she probably doesn't want to bother with a nasal spray or injectable. She probably wants to be very, you know, pop a tablet. So I would first try a triptan if she had tolerability issues. Common example, some of my patients get really tired from a triptan, and you can't be tired if you're in court. So if she had a problem with a triptan, then I would go with one of the GPANs, like ubrogepant or rimegepant.
Yeah, I think that's very reasonable. In all of the excitement, and it is exciting to have these new medicines. It does. I don't think any of us are suggesting that we throw the triptans out with the bathwater, so to speak, because there are patients who do well, they're satisfied with them, and they're generic. There's no reason to run away from that. But of course, we all have patients who don't do well, get side effects and need other medicine. So it's, you know, I the day when I can treat every one of my patients and they're 100% happy, that's when I'll stop being interested in new treatments. Sadly, I think I'll be dead before that happens. So let's, I think that's very reasonable. Let's see if we can, who else we can talk about. We've got Maria, 35-year-old translator, chronic migraine, frequency would be up to 20 a month, very burdensome, working full time. Keeps her from working full time. So this is a real economic cost for her and the community. So she wants something she can take with her morning medication to provide continuous coverage versus taking dose every day. She wants a preventive, Cynthia. She wants a preventive.
Yes. So I look at this type of patient, and obviously the burden of migraine is high. And I think about the gamut of preventives that are available, different types. Some patients prefer something that they want to take every day that really helps them understand that there's consistency in the levels are being maintained. And some patients want something monthly or every 3 months. So over here, I think the data that we have on atogepant really speaks to this, for someone wanting to take something every day as opposed to taking acute doses. Other than that, we do have rimegepant that is also FDA approved for prevention. So you can argue that this person can do rimegepant. However, that's something that's taken every other day. I have some patients that like that as opposed to daily, but some may find that a little burdensome because you have to keep remembering something every other day. So over here, I think she's mainly appropriate for atogepant.
And of course, I mean, you could have the discussion with her about monthly injection of a monoclonal. It'd be, there's nothing naughty about having that discussion. And indeed, we'd need to, you'd explore what of the classic preventives that she might have had. I mean, they're not great drugs, you know, you take a 35-year-old and you put them on propranolol and they can't and they can't run out of sight on a dark night. That's not very helpful. Or you put them onto topiramate and all of a sudden she can't translate from her own language, let alone translate into another language. So I don't think that's an unfair criticism of those drugs. One of the reasons that we think in headache we've really embraced these new medicines is because they're so well tolerated. I said it in the presentations, right across the board. And it gives patients a chance to be well and to be really well, as opposed to just be a little bit well and still have a side effect. So, yeah, lots of good options. Susan, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we do have to ask her about any history of some of the standard generic oral preventives. It's a shame we can't go straight to things like rimegepant or atogepant, but the reality is, you know, most of the time we have to deal with insurance companies. But I would look forward in the future, Peter and Cynthia, when we can go straight to what we feel is the most appropriate medication for that patient.
Yeah, I really like having the discussion, particularly, I think, on preventive, around what is right for you. I mean, you could even hear, let me throw it into the mix, you could even hear a praiser of the existence of neuromodulation approaches. I mean, she may turn around and say, I'm 35, actually, I want to have a child. Oh, okay. Let's have a conversation about neuromodulation approaches. So this is a very rich discussion that you can have because you could really get inside a person's head about where they're going. So let's try another case. We've got Wanda. She's a 27-year-old PhD candidate in pharmacology. So we are going to have to know something about the drugs to talk to. And that's not unreasonable. Becomes nauseous from migraine, caused her to struggle with research, wants freedom to take a treatment, but also to take preventatively when migraine frequency increases, such as during the menstrual cycle. She's looking for quite a lot of flexibility. Susan.
Oh, I think the ultimate flexibility here would be rimegepant, because it's the only gepant that's approved for both acute treatment but preventive. And I think what Wanda would like is a short-term preventive approach so that when her migraine frequency increases, we can say take the rimegepant every other day. The other times of the month, just take it as needed. So I think this is a great example of the flexibility that you have in particular with rimegepant.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Unfortunately, we understand the pharmacology, so we can have a sensible discussion with her. Let's take the next case of Sophia. So 33-year-old female nurse, nausea and vomiting and migraine start. Troubled keeping medicines down, works in an ED. So she needs something that works pretty fast, Cynthia.
Yeah, so when I think about this, I think about medications that are non-oral, because A, she wants to keep something down, also wants something that works very quickly. So historically, we have medications that exist like injectable triptans, for example. So I'd want to scan through what she's tried before and see if that's something that she's taken, if she's tried a triptan in the past and that actually works, but now she needs something that works faster. I might stick to that category of medications. But in this, certainly, we can try intranasal. So zavegepant would be a great choice for someone like this, especially if they want a non-oral route. And I think that's appropriate for her. And in some cases, you could consider something like rimegepant for people who may be medication adverse to routes that are injectable or intranasal, because there are patients that, despite the circumstances, they don't want it. So many of my patients do like the option of taking something that they can swallow quickly without water. Yeah. Not the best. We would have that conversation, what's the best for you? But that's a good choice for something that acts quickly when someone doesn't want to take a nasal spray or an injectable.
Now, I like setting out the choices, as you say. If you set out some choices and a person selects one, so that's a very good choice, because that's the one that they made, and they're going to go home happy. There's nothing wrong with that. And they're going to try the medicine in the way you suggested, because they're on board. And, you know, if people use these medicines as we ask them to, they actually work pretty well. It's when they don't use them or they're kind of a bit skeptical about what you're doing, you have more problems with just getting people's head around things. So you know, I completely agree with you. You've got to really listen to a person in what they're saying. So a little bit of discussion. How do we determine whether a patient should receive a preventive or stick with their acute treatment? How do we do that? So, Susan, come back to you.
Oh, I think it comes down to, again, patient preference. I think that that collaborative approach in which we take into account the patient's needs and wants and desires, because I think we've all had patients that have maybe as many as 15 headache days a month, but they say, Dr. Hutchinson, I don't want to go on a preventive. You know, my acute works well. Other people may want to go on a preventive for as few as 2 or 3 headache days a month because of the degree of disability. So, again, I think this is very much driven by an individual discussion with each patient.
Yes, I completely agree. Cynthia?
Yeah, I also want to pay attention to the type of migraine that they're having and, again,
yes,
the burden of that. So
yeah,
someone might have hemiplegic migraine where they cannot move one side of their body. You might want to put someone like that on a preventive and convince them that's the right approach for them to even prevent even half of those episodes from happening.
Yeah, exactly. It can be very scary, those attacks. I've certainly put patients on preventive who have a few of attacks that scare them actually witless. Otherwise, it's perfectly reasonable. You know, you've got to listen to the history. Well, time is running away on us, so let me just take us on to this. SMART goals. We hope that the program today's helped people develop a better understanding of migraine, the diagnosis and the use of CGRP inhibitors. And we want to finish by summarizing our SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. So identifying the disparities associated with the diagnosis and treatment of migraine and which strategies we can use to combat them. We want to utilize screening and diagnostic tools when seeing patients with complaints of headache and assessing migraine. And we want to implement the clinical data and efficacy and the safety tolerability data that we have for these CGRP inhibitors, these GPANs, when we're developing patient-centered, patient-tailored treatment programs for migraine. Now, there have been questions coming in, and we haven't gotten to all of them. We've had the post-test surveys being pushed to you, and we're a little bit down on time, so we will try. We can provide answers to these, and the CME folks can probably be able to provide them to you. So after the show, the questions and answers, visit the Migraine Education Hub for free resources and education to education for healthcare professionals and patients. And one of the questions was, how do you receive your CME? Well, to receive CME credit for this activity, you must complete the post-test and evaluation online. Click on the Request Credit tab to complete the process and print your certificate. And I'd like to particularly thank Susan Hutchinson and Cynthia Armand for joining me today and for your involvement and the answering the questions, and the audience for really being great about getting involved in the patient in the responses. So I'd like to thank everyone, and I'll say my goodbye and invite my colleagues to say goodbye.
Oh yes, goodbye. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.